Although I think you have to be a lawyer.
This is my permanent thing I got asked for.
House Committee on Revenue will come to order. We appreciate your attendance this afternoon, and we're only a couple of minutes late getting started. We do not have possible bill introductions for today, so we're going to skip the work session, and we're going to continue where we left off yesterday with the material from Basic Facts.
That's right. Mr. Chair, we had three presentations, or four, I guess, and then Somazin's going to talk about basically kind of the back of the report around lottery, OLCC, and some other excise tax.
Great.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Von Hart, members of the committee. At least 50%, or almost 50%, new faces. So I have Mazen Malik with Legislative Revenue. And just to orient you with this, what I do here, I used to say, and veteran members would know, that if you smoke, drink, or gamble, I am the kind of guy that will tax you. We'll also take you with 911 and transportation, transport you to where you want to go. And then at the end, if you die, I'm still there for you. Well, luckily, my portfolio got a lot better. Mm-hmm. I gave up tobacco completely.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And accordingly, I also gave up death. So I'm not
forever.
Gave up the ghost.
So that's Kyle will be doing these things.
I think that will be the quote of the day.
And well, you know, it is also, I have to remind you, it is actually worth something to live for. Today, or this month, is about 823 years away from the next February, when you have four Mondays, four Tuesdays, four Wednesdays, four Thursdays, and so on. So we'll be waiting for that. And until then, we'll have some, I'm going to take you with the liquor taxes, or what we do with liquor in the state. So this is the J2 with the tax packet, page J2 and on. And just to quickly go through this, we look at liquor. Of course, there are two types that we, and we are accordingly, two types of taxes that we apply to liquor. So we have a tax on beer and wine and cider and so on. These are done by a tax on a percentage type of thing by unit. And then we have a markup on the spirits. So, but let's quickly go with what we have on beer and wine. Beer, we tax it by the barrel, or what we have at $2 per 60, and it is about 31.5 gallons. So that comes back to about 8.4 cents per gallon. You know, a lot of people would like to talk about the six packs at about 4.5 cents per six pack, or about 5 cents, less than 5 cents per six pack of beer. And beer basically has a long history of taxation. I have a table for you here going all the way from 91, 92 until 13, 14. And with that, you would have included also wine. Wine has a taxation per gallon, the regular wine, or what you drink every day, and then the dessert wine, and they are 10 cents difference per gallon, from 67 cents to 77 cents, and that basically comes to about 13 and a quarter per bottle, if you will. And they both, these two types of taxes on beer and wine, each generate about $7.5 million per year. So you end up with about $13 million for both. Not great amount, but these taxes have not changed for a long time. And if you want to look at where we rank as a state, you have on the page after that a table where you look at the different table wine and the malt liquor, which is a beer, and where Oregon ranks with that. And you would see with the beer, Oregon ranks about 51, which is about the last of all states. And that's including both sales tax and excise tax. So if you put them all together, you have Oregon ranking, of course, with 51. We didn't add a state; it's just District of Columbia included as a rank. And then table wine, we go to about the 47th, and also here in the table you have how it compares with the cigarette tax. But that's from a different time on a different world for me. I decided to live. That's how we do the liquor taxes in beer and wine. Then slightly different is what we deal with the distilled liquors or the spirits. This is the stuff that goes through OLCC. OLCC primarily does a markup. Oregon as a state, still a controlled state. One out of 17, still in the union out of the 50 states. OLCC gets a markup. That means they import all the liquor to the warehouse, as they say. And on top of all the transportation costs and federal taxes, they mark up the price to about 100 and some percent. And that would be the end price, and they sell that, then they collect their costs and their amounts and so on, and they transfer the rest to the account, the OLCC account, and that has a distribution that gets also 50% of the beer and wine, and it distributes about 56% to the general fund. And you would see the rest here that you would have. A lot of it, about 24% or so, goes to cities, and the rest to different amounts. It's worth mentioning also that 50% of the beer and wine revenues go to the mental health and addiction programs. So that's enough with drinking. The lottery thing that's in K-1, lottery, and the lottery basically is the official type of gambling that is sanctioned in the state. This was done by an initiative petition in 1984 to allow for the lottery to be created. And the lottery, of course, you have two types. You have the traditional games, and you have the video lottery. The traditional games are the ones that came first. They first came with the one type of a scratch, which I don't think it still exists today. But in the Constitution at that time, it was dedicated to economic development. With time, that changed. And it changed in many ways, the most important of which is dedicating by Measure 66, that Measure 21 in May 95, about 15% to the what then used to be known the Education Endowment Fund. And the Education Endowment Fund has changed with time to what you know as now today the Education Stability Fund. The Education Stability Fund also gets an additional 3%. So when it was moved and changed, it became an 18% of the lottery immediate transfers to it. These are constitutionally dedicated, and those for educational uses now. If the Education Stability Fund gets more than 5% of what the general fund is worth at a certain time, the amount starts changing to an account, which is the capital matching sub-account, and it reduces to about 15%. Now, I don't think that ever happened, so every time we have the Education Stability Fund and it builds up or for the 5% of the general fund, 5% of the general fund is probably close to $1 billion. And I think it seems to be by the time we build up to that amount, unfortunately, we have to drain the account because of either a recession or some kind of fallout and so on. So I don't think the capital matching sub-account has ever been filled with money at this point. So that's the important things with the lottery. The thing that came with the video lottery is 1989. The legislature actually authorized it. However, it was delayed, postponed, vetoed by the governor then, Governor Goldschmidt. And then in 91, this was reinstated again, and video lottery started in 1992. And all of a sudden, once it started, it just kind of got that jump into the revenues and started growing. That's video poker. And again, with the introduction of line games, that's in 2004, video lottery took another jump, as you would see from the graph over there where you have that big jump. That's basically came from the introduction of line games. Those line games with the video lottery and all that brought up the amounts of lottery going to state budget to about $1 billion in revenue in a biennium. So it became a really significant amount. However, in the 2007, 2008, and 2009, or what we call the recession, or the Great Recession, in addition to having the, if you recall, the smoking ban from bars and restaurants, and remember the lottery happens always with OLCC permits, which means it's always that is coupled with that permit, so it's 21 and over. With the smoking ban and the amount and the Great Recession, lottery started receding very quickly. In 2 years, it lost about almost more than 10% each year. Total for those 2 years, it went down by about 20% in those recession years in 9 and 10. And then it started growing again. Now we forecast the lottery to be on a more sustainable amount of about 1.8 to 2% a year. You have here in front of you a couple tables. One would do the different amounts of where the lottery, the traditional games and the video lottery are, and also the allocation of the lottery transfers. I remember different times and different initiatives have put different amounts of dedications to the lottery. These are the ones that are dedicated either by constitution or by statutes. And I think part of Measure 66 put the first call on the revenue from the lottery to the revenue bonds. So the bonds get their payments first, and then everything else gets its share. All right, well, couple things I would like to talk to you quickly, and I don't think they made it this time in the basic facts, but two other areas that we deal with. It's the 911 tax or the emergency tax. The 911 tax is primarily a tax that started way in about 1981 to fund the 911 program. In 1981, it was at 3% of sales. The what do you call it? The amounts of payments on lines. In 91, that went to about 5% of the access charge. So they call it the access charge rather than a line then. In 1995, it became a 75 cents per circuit. And a circuit is defined as the line that goes out. So rather, if you have a box of many lines, only the ones, there is a limited numbers that could actually dial 911, and that's what you pay on. So the 75 cents went on until a long time, and it was every few years, every 6 years or so, it sunsets. There was a sunset happening in January 1st, 2014. There was an extension of that sunset in the 2013 session by then House Bill 3317. I think this committee is familiar with it. It was instrumental in passing that. So the extension of the 911 went to January 1st, 2022. Now, in the interim session or the 2014 session, there was a discussion of how to change the funding or the base for the 911 in order to include the prepaid cellular phones, and these are not part of the older base per se, or it wasn't explicitly part of that. So there was House Bill 4055, and what it did, it moved the 75 cents to a per transaction of these prepaid phones. So, and it made the main thing, made it made two transitional periods, one of a transitional period of 9 months starting January of this year, actually, 2015, and it goes till October. And that would continue with the same way that is being collected today, that is the 75 cents per line. And then after that, you would have the, which is what we call the provider pay, then you would have the transaction, 75 cents per transaction type. 911 revenue is about $39 million per year. For the first time this year, that was interesting, and you would find it in page A7, the one that we put in the front of all the different taxes. The 911 revenue for the first time in about 5 years, we saw a small blip up for 911 revenue. That wasn't necessarily expected. We were expecting continual trending down. That this time, at least, was slightly good news for them. And finally, I want to talk also about a bill that also was done in the 2013 session. This took a lot of work and effort from this committee. This is the transient lodging tax. Transient lodging tax is a tax that is at the 1% of the amounts, payments and receipts or sales of transient lodging. That's both hotel, motels, and other transient lodgings. And this is a result of House Bill 2267 of 2003, where it became at 1%, and it dedicated that amount to the tourism industry or tourism commission. And it also put a moratorium on other types of local taxes. And that moratorium says if you are to increase that, you would have to spend it about 75% on tourism promotion. Now, the thing that changed with House Bill 2656 in 2013 is that the transient lodging tax became a tax that is collected not only, especially for the internet type of providers. It became that you would have to collect on the final sale price that you sell and you give to the customer, rather than on the wholesale price that previously done. That is, we expected to generate about a couple million dollars for both local and state. Now, the one thing to remember that about the transient lodging tax is not necessarily all a state type of tax revenue. It primarily started as a local type of tax. There's about 85 cities in Oregon and 15 counties that collect that type of tax. The average, if you want to, it goes from all about 2% to about 13.5%. Average of all the transient lodging taxes is about 8.7%. You would expect. So the state collects this year in 2014 collected about 13.9 or $14 million. And the local governments collected about $121 million for transient lodging taxes. And I think that does it for me. Mm-hmm.
Questions? Yes, ma'am. Representative Wetzel.
Yes. On the transient lodging tax, did you say that about 75% goes to tourism promotion, or what? I missed what you said exactly.
Well, the 1% that is a state, and that's the state institution or the state amount of the tax. All of it goes to tourism promotion. It put a moratorium at that time in place for local governments, cities and counties, saying if any local government is to institute a new level of tax. So it grandfathered in whatever happened was in existence at that time. So if a new tax would be put in, 75% of that needs to be spent on tourism promotion before it's spent any other way.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, and my congratulations for giving up tobacco and death.
And deciding to live, right?
Mr. Chair, we do have him working on marijuana, though.
Oh, okay. Well, he'll be more mellow than in the future.
Yeah, that make life more worth living.
And we have one more segment of the basic facts to go, don't we?
Mr. Chair, it's kind of an appendage to the basic facts, just a segue into your discussion around the bills. It's entitled Potential House Revenue Committee Issues 2015. So it's just kind of a highlight the issues. This is really was based on discussions with the chair and the vice chairs and what would be the key issues going forward, so I can go through those very quickly.
Why don't you?
Okay.
Yeah. And then we'll go on to the other items we have on our
calendar. Okay. And then we have the Revenue Department folks to go through the tax expenditure report with you.
Great.
If you look at the list there, and of course, always the caveat that there could well be issues that would arise, big issues that are not on this. The tax credit policy is, of course, as you know now, is in our third regular session of dealing with the sunset process. We're in the third and final group that was originally established back in 2009. The key numbers, of course, are that you're looking at about $64 million to extend those 18 credits as they currently are. We have a list of those specifically, and Chris is going to go through a full report on those here following the tax expenditure report. There's about $64 million there. The co-chairs have allocated $14 million. So that gives you a sense of kind of what the environment is for you.
And that doesn't count what else we might do either.
That's right. So it's a 14 net figure, yes. And, of course, the leadership has established the Joint Tax Credit Committee with the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee, so that process has been set up and we would anticipate that getting into full gear toward the end of the session. We have went ahead and introduced 18 straight sunset credit bills, six-year extensions, and one in each chamber. So those are now before the policy committees. So we've sent Chris to help them and kind of sort through those, and those should be coming to the joint committee. The second issue I have there is really kind of an extension of that and something that I know you've talked about. We've talked about in this committee.
Excuse me just a moment, Representative Vance.
A question, Paul, because I can't recall. The $14 million, is that the amount that then be used over the three-year life of these six? Or is it just this biennium? I've forgotten the rules.
Representative Vance, it's the biennial figure. I mean, it's the budget figure. So that came from the co-chairs, and when they're allocating their budget framework, they've set aside $14 million. Our estimate is it's about $64 million to extend those for 15-17.
Without any changes.
Without any changes. Thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah. Just to add to that, if I could, the co-chairs have already built, as you know, have already built their outline for the budget. The governor had allocated the entire $64 million in his budget for this purpose, as I understand it. The co-chair said, no, we want to spend 50 of that on something else. What that means is that this committee is going to have to figure out how to present a bill or a set of bills that don't spend more than $14 million. And I might as well telegraph that it's my hope that we can deal with the tax credits that ought to be renewed without prejudging that at all, and do it in a way that that spends even less than the $14 million. That's a trick, and it's going to require. One other comment I'll make about that, because Paul raised the issue of the Tax Credit Committee. We haven't figured out exactly when that committee is going to meet, but you ought to be prepared for the likelihood that it will either meet during the time set aside for the Finance and Revenue Committee at 8:30 in the morning on Monday through Thursday, or at the time for this committee, 1 o'clock Monday through Thursday, or on different days, both. Or either. So just simply be aware that you might find yourself in a committee meeting at 8:30 in the morning that you hadn't planned on very far in advance, because we'll be meeting with the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. Fortunately, they're a very small group, and we will make room for them. Paul, go ahead.
Okay. Just a couple other points about that. The tax credit policy. You see the number there for 17-19 is $135 million, and that's important to keep that in mind, that there is, when we look at the biennium you're budgeting toward, it's usually about half of what we would expect it to be in the next biennium. And then that's because they sunset in 2016. So you're really picking up 1 year of credit impact in 15-17. You get the full 2 years. It's what the budget folks would call a roll-up. Now, the other point, there's a last sentence there in that paragraph. In addition to these individual credits, recent court decisions have raised the issue of the legislature's intent tax credits toward the corporate minimum tax, and that's the Conway decision, and that is potentially an issue too, because that's obviously an overall general tax credit policy. Do you want those tax credits to be applicable to the corporate minimum? And right now, the courts are saying they're interpreting the law as that they're not. That they can be applied to the credits. The credits can be applied to the minimum. The second issue there is on the expansion of the tax expenditure review process. Related, you have a number of bills that look at this issue. You've of course spent time dealing with tax expenditures. We're calling the special session the senior medical deduction, which is not a credit but a deduction. So there's a whole series of tax expenditures that are not covered in this sunset review process that applies only to credits. So that's always an issue. Is there other things you want to extend it? You have a bill that would kind of sets up a framework for a sunset review process for the non-credit income tax expenditures, and another bill for the property tax exemptions. So that process. And, of course, those are kind of different animals in the credit. So it may require different approaches, particularly some of the things around property tax expenditures that are, you don't tax federal land, for example, because of federal law, not because of a state policy decision. And those end up being quite large, and I'm sure the Craig and John will talk about that in terms of the tax expenditure report. The third issue is the policies to offset the impact of falling subsidies as wages rise, the so-called benefit cliff. You had some discussion about this. The governor's office said they were working on some proposals, and we have been working with them in terms of analyzing potential effects. Right now we have a placeholder bill to look at that, so that'll be an opportunity to look at some of the potential effects. I should emphasize that you know, this the benefit and credit impact is really focused on those who are extensive users of the credits and subsidies, and I think there's been some confusion about that, suggesting that it might apply very widely. Obviously, if you're not using credits and subsidies, then it's the benefit cliff is not going to affect you. And there may be other issues, maybe other policies that might. But really the focus here is as those subsidies, and the main one is around dependent care. That's the largest. The working family credit is one of the tax credits you have up for review. But as those are phased out, as income rises, then you get this effect of purchasing power basically being level or potentially even declining. And that was one of the initial things that the earned income tax credit and the working family credit were designed to address. Another issue is incentives, tax policy incentives to provide adequate wages. There's obviously an interaction between the wages that are earned in the marketplace versus the benefits and the state budget. It affects it both in terms of revenue collected and also in terms, of course, expenditures through subsidies. So are there ways to use the tax policy to try to encourage those kind of adequate wages? The next issue I've listed there is an extension from 2013. That's around the tax haven. As you recall, you established a list of jurisdictions, countries that are designated as tax havens. What that bill did was, if there is any subsidiary of a consolidated group that is headquartered in one of those designated countries, then the income reported in that group is added back to the water's edge calculation and then apportioned to Oregon. We estimate that bill itself would raise roughly about $20 million per year. The other element of that bill was to require the Department of Revenue to review the countries that are on that list and make recommendations for any change in that list. They will be here tomorrow to go through that their report. They are making some pretty significant recommendations to include some countries that are actually have a little bit larger economies than the ones you have on the list currently. The major ones are the Netherlands, Switzerland, and Hong Kong. And we have already been getting literature and calls from the Swiss embassy and the Dutch embassy. So that material will be for you from them. The input from them will be on the OLIS for you tomorrow.
And, of course, the ambassadors would be welcome to come and testify in front of the committee if they prefer to do that.
Or there's the possibility of a road trip, Mr. Chair.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
Okay. Use that next one.
So, but the report itself is, they did a good job of going through what are the elements that would constitute a tax haven and analyzing each of those, the countries that are currently on your list. The difficult thing for us, as it was initially, any changes you make on the list, we don't have any data really to turn to. We've got aggregate data from what the amount of reported profits are by U.S. affiliates by country. So we've got that data, and that's kind of interesting, and we'll share that with you when you get into that issue. But right now you have a placeholder bill for possible changes in that statute. On the other side of your issues list, these are things that the interim committee certainly has talked about and from last session. Carbon tax feasibility, you got the report from that you designated us to do, appropriated as $200,000, and we subcontracted with the Northwest Economic Research Center. You got that report, been presented to you, which gave us a good kind of a macro view of what the potential economic implications are. And then, of course, there's some other issues around implementation and also an issue around potential other ways of achieving the goal. And the one that specifically comes up and is discussed, and I know we talked about in revenue and energy environment, is around a cap and trade. Is, are there, and what kind of an option would be. Yeah. What are the implications of those different alternatives?
And the implication of that last sentence about coordination with energy and environment is that Chair Vega Peterson and I had a conversation a while ago in which we agreed that because this concept lends itself to the topic of her committee, that these things would initiate in it would be considered first in energy and environment, because it makes sense to look at all the different methods together rather than piecing it out. The reason this committee was involved at all is because we commissioned the study. But now hopefully that study is of use to energy and environment, and they'll take whatever action they consider to be appropriate. I don't anticipate that we will do very much on that issue here unless something comes out of energy and environment that involves something that's within our jurisdiction, and the bill would end up being referred here by a subsequent referral. Is that a reasonable summary of what we agreed,
yeah.
Representative?
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
Another issue that we had extensive hearing on in the interim was around the potential taxation of vapor products, the electronic cigarettes and other means of vapor products. As you recall, we had an investment analyst expert on the industry from Wells Fargo that predicted that within 5 years that the vaping industry will be larger than the traditional tobacco industry. And, of course, in the current tax system, you tax tobacco products, of which these electronic cigarettes and vapor products are not part of that tax base. They don't meet the definitions that you have currently in law. So that's a potential area there. Another one where you have a wide variety of policy areas affected. The next issue, the central assessment and taxation of communication properties, another one that this committee has wrestled with, particularly in terms of the data centers. The central assessment issue, the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee introduced some concepts yesterday and had an informational hearing this morning on this issue, and they are working with a work group that has both our chair and vice chair, Megan Peterson, on it, and as well as Representative McLean, have been involved working with the Senate members on possible solutions. We're really looking at two different things. One would be to narrowly focus on the data center definition, and the second would be to come up with a broader solution to deal with an old problem that's been an issue since I've been here, and that goes way back. is to how to treat intangible property for centrally assessed properties.
Right.
So they're working on some solutions there, and they'll coordinate with the work group, and then eventually something comes over, we'll obviously come here.
And if I could, the key issue, I think, is that we are now dealing with some very large businesses that do not have much, if any, facilities in Oregon, that where most of the value of the business is intangible. And if we would like to have them do developments in Oregon, we have to do it. We are going to have to figure out a way to deal with the reality of the fact that most of their value is intangible, and that they're not coming here if we try to tax that huge intangible value, the majority of their intangible value. On the other hand, we want to be careful not to give away revenue that counties, cities, school districts and others need, and what we end up with, it needs to be fair. So we're hoping that we can actually untie a knot that we've been working on, that the legislature has been working on since, I think, 1999, isn't it, and hasn't been successful at. At minimum, we're hoping to get at least some very specific carve-outs into effect to deal with the issue that Representative McLean is most interested in, having to do with the data center in his district and a couple of other data centers. But hopefully we can do a little more than that, and we'll see.
Okay, the next issue is another old favorite, which is the reserve fund policy and the 2% surplus kicker. The state, of course, has made some major strides in reserve fund policy, and following the recessions of the 2000s, there was the, Mazin mentioned the Education Stability Fund out of lottery. You also have the Oregon Rainy Day Fund, which receives a portion of the ending balance, but you also, that remember that was capitalized by the legislative action to where we had a large corporate kicker was projected, and on a one-time basis, the legislature had a two-thirds vote and put that in the reserve fund. We're looking at some other ways. The kicker itself, we think, is really a very real possibility. We're only about $29 million from the threshold. And one of the things to keep in mind, and we'll get our update from a state economist on the 19th, but keep in mind that the kicker is not only the personal income tax collections, but it's anything else in the general fund that's not corporate. And one of the things, ironically, we've seen a lot of strength here the last 6 months has been estate taxes, and they're part of that calculation. So all those things add up, and so we are seeing some general strength in the economy, and we are very close to that threshold. So that's going to be an issue of uncertainty for the co-chairs making the budget. We have some concepts around potential statutory changes that would link volatile components of revenue to the reserve fund, and your most volatile component there that would be the focus of attention is capital gains. We calculate that our standard deviation of prediction on the capital gains per biennium is about 40%. So that's just basically all over the map. So that's our biggest source of volatility on the forecast. Other issues we had there, business taxation. Again, an issue the committee has looked at a lot, particularly around Measure 67 and the corporate minimum tax when that was developed in this committee. But also some other possibilities. We've been looking at other ways to tax business income that might potentially provide greater efficiency in terms of collections. And one example we've looked at is the commercial activity tax. Was established in Ohio back in 2006, has been operational now for about 7 years. So that we'll look at that and provide some information for you on that. The last two issues, reconnection to the federal taxable income. We've talked, we're working to set up a date for your annual visit from the CPAs. And they will go through the list of what we call extenders, which were the extensions that the federal government approved. They usually wait till the last minute. This year they got them done in December. So we'll go through those. Of course, the vast majority of those we automatically reconnect to through the rolling reconnect provision. But we're working on that impact. Christine is working on that, and that will be built into the February forecast because that's current law. But we'll also give you an idea of those effects. And then plus some other issues that will be associated with the reconnect bill. And then the last issue is something the committee has not looked at in depth for quite a while. It's timber taxation. Used to take a lot of time of this committee as that timber taxation has evolved over a number of different mechanisms. A lot of it, of course, was affected by Measure 5. So we'll revisit that with you. We have a informational report for you for next week to kind of start that discussion.
Great. What have we missed? It's early enough in the session that if members have specific, have general issues that they'd like to raise, or out of the 100-plus bills we have, the bills that you'd like to be heard, get in touch with me and the mechanism that we're using is that the vice chairs and I and Paul will discuss our agendas and figure out what we're going to post and go from there. It looks like we have a lot of time. The fact is we don't. We're going to fly in order to get our work done, and that's always the way it works. So the earlier you let your druthers be known, the more likely it is that we'll actually get to them. Thank you. So let's go to the department.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we work very closely with the Revenue Research Unit, and two of their prominent members are here, Craig Fisher and John Hart. When the legislature passed the tax expenditure report legislation that directed the department to produce a report to be consistent with the governor's recommended budget come out at that time, Revenue Research has been in charge of that project since, and they'll talk about the report. We also have some hard copies, if there's interest in hard copies. We're selling them at half price.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. My name is Craig Fisher. I'm the research manager for the Department of Revenue. And with me is John Hart, who is a senior economist with the department. I might add that we will sign copies if you'd like at a higher price, if that makes them any more valuable. But as Paul mentioned, he asked us to provide you with an overview of the tax expenditure report, and we understand it's a fairly imposing document. And so what we'd like to do is provide you with some context in some ways that we think may make the publication more useful to you. What we'll do is John will begin by providing some context and some description of the conceptual framework of the tax expenditure, both generally and as it applies to Oregon, and give you some ways to sort of look at that in various categories. And then I'll describe a little bit about the specific requirements of the book and give you some heads up on some things to look for.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to have the opportunity to talk about a very complicated topic in a very brief way this afternoon. Starting with a general overview of the concept of tax expenditures, about 50 years ago in the late 60s, the U.S. Treasury published their first report on tax expenditures after the Assistant Treasury Secretary noted that a lot of exemptions and credits in the tax code look a lot like direct spending programs. The state of Oregon caught up in 1995, and the Legislative Revenue Office, I think, actually produced the first tax expenditure compendium in 1995. And in that year, the Budget Accountability Act was passed in Oregon that said that tax expenditures are similar to direct expenditures, and that the production of a tax expenditure report in Oregon will allow looking at tax expenditures in the same way that direct expenditures are looked at. The 1995 Act gave a very particular definition for tax expenditures in Oregon. This is a little different than the way it's viewed at the federal level or in other states. Basically, the exact words are that a tax expenditure in Oregon is defined as any law of the federal government or this state that exempts in whole or in part certain persons, income, goods, services, or property from the impact of established taxes, including but not limited to tax deductions, tax exclusions, tax subtractions, tax exemptions, tax deferrals, preferential tax rates, and tax credits. So that's quite the laundry list, and we try to prepare the book in those categories.
Excuse me, just a moment. Representative Vance.
Just a question. The earlier definition, could you go back to it just for a second? Right there. It says are similar to direct expenditures. They didn't say identical. What's the difference?
Mr. Chair, Representative, some of the, so a credit is the most like a direct expenditure, and a refundable credit is the most like a direct expenditure of any of the tax credits. So
I'm only interested in the first, the credit, not the refundable one. Can you just talk about the tax credit? That's the one I'm most interested in, that one. And to get to the point, for us to see if it's exactly the same, wouldn't we have to do a reconciliation, as we've often asked Chris to do, to see if indeed the $14 million that the Ways and Means folks are expecting us to spend actually got spent, or the $65 actually got used? That's my real question. I want to know how real that number is when it comes to talking about tax credits.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative, one thing to note is that every number in the tax expenditure report is an estimate, partly because of the timing. We don't have tax information for credits that are used. So, for instance, credits used for economic activity occurring in 2014, we won't have really good information on for another year. And so we don't, even for the 13-15 biennium, the first number reported on each tax expenditure, we don't have complete information on the amount that was used or the amount of revenue reduction from that credit. And so you would need to look back in time to see what the revenue reduction from anything was. But the similarity for a tax credit comes from if the state wants to support child care, it can provide, for instance, a 20% tax credit for the cost of child care, or it can provide a check that covers 20% of the cost of child care. And that's really where the similarity is seen by most people.
Thank you.
It's also worth noting that there's some ambiguity, that we actually wrestle with the idea of what is and isn't a tax expenditure, whether a particular provision of law is more than one tax expenditure. And so some of the things that are estimates in the book may look more concrete than they actually are. They are all estimates and really should be thought of as kind of order of magnitude estimates in a lot of cases. With that, we have a summary of the expenditures included in the book. The count for this edition of the book is 372 tax expenditures. So if you were to read one a day, it would take you longer than a year to become fully familiar with these. Of that, 336 tax expenditures are listed in the income tax and the property tax program. So those are really the largest of the chapters in the book that are organized by tax program. There's a total of 15 chapters. And this table, we actually say in the book to be careful about adding up the total of the tax expenditures, and then we provide a table that does that. This table compares those added up tax expenditures to the estimated revenue in the same programs. And so, for instance, you can look at property tax and estimated property tax revenues for 2015-2017 are $12.4 billion, where the estimated revenue impact of tax expenditures for that same period is $25.9 billion. And those comparisons are often made.
And, of course, a big chunk of that is that federal property that Chris was referring to, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, we'll talk about the top 10 for property tax. The federal property and the intangible personal property are
the two big ones.
I think they are the actually state and local property falls in between those. But we'll have a slide on the property tax coming up after the top 10.
I'll try not to ask questions ahead and let you do your presentation.
Mr. Chair, you're welcome to ask questions, obviously. So the top 10 income tax expenditures are shown here. We've highlighted in blue there the three that are direct provisions of Oregon law. It's worth noting that these top 10 out of a total that we saw on the last page of 204 income tax expenditures, these top 10 comprise 61%, and all the others are the remainder. The big ones are really exclusions, things that are not reported on tax returns at all, the employer-paid medical benefits and the pension contributions and earnings. And then we have Oregon's personal exemption credit and home mortgage interest deduction, and those four are all in the neighborhood of $1 billion or more at this point for the biennial impact. For property tax expenditures, the top 10 here represent it's the top 10 of 132 total. The top 10 represent 97% of the total. And you can see the very first one, intangible personal property, which is mostly made up of the financial assets of Oregonians, is 60% of the total there at $15.4 billion all by itself. And so that one actually drives a lot of the, when you look at total change in property tax expenditures, the estimated impacts are largely driven by this one that makes up most of the total. State and local property, federal property, and personal property for personal use are the next three. And then inventory, the business inventories, is the rounds out the top five. And again, that's this top 10 makes up 97%. So the rest, while not necessarily small, are small relative to these. One way to look at the tax expenditures that are reported here is to categorize them into areas that are more like direct spending and less like direct spending. And the area that is most like direct spending are the incentives to encourage certain activities, things like economic development exemptions, subtraction for contributions to education savings accounts, and financial assistance to certain taxpayers, the earned income credit, the working family, the child care credit. Those are most like direct spending, and when they become refundable or when an entity can qualify for a credit and sell it to another entity, or when the credits are based on auctions, those are the provisions that are most like direct spending. Those provisions that are less like direct spending include provisions to simplify compliance or administration. One example of that is if an Oregonian goes into another state and buys a carton of cigarettes and smokes one of those cigarettes, there's a provision that exempts that the 199 cigarettes that are left from Oregon tax if they drive back to Oregon with it. That simplifies the compliance and administration. And we have things like federal property that can't be taxed because it's prohibited by federal law. And so that's much less like direct spending than a lot of the other provisions.
I'd say.
Yes.
Question.
What's it, please?
I was just wondering, do you consider the green energy credits that the state has been giving for wind and solar and weatherization and all that under a tax expenditure then? Because it's an incentive to encourage certain activities.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is a provision that I think could be relatively easily replaced with a direct spending program. And so it is more like direct spending than some of the other provisions, yes.
Okay. Have you included that in any of your lists? I was just wondering what the total amount might be over the past 2 years and how far into the future we're sending those credits out.
Mr. Chair, Representative, those provisions, if they're tax provisions, they are included in the book with a description and with the sunset date and with estimates of the impacts and the benefits to taxpayers.
Great, thanks.
Mm-hmm. The report is statutorily required to include various pieces of information, so I thought I'd just step through the information that's provided in the book and maybe give you some pointers on what may be useful to you as you use the book. The statutory authority is required. That's kind of clear. We also provide for those provisions that we connect to the federal definition of taxable income, we provide the federal statutory reference as well. A purpose statement is required for every tax expenditure, and that is quite significant because, as I'll talk about later, it's necessary that these be evaluated according to whether they accomplish their purpose. And so not every tax expenditure has an explicit purpose statement in statute. Occasionally there is some specific language that describes the purpose of the statute. Sometimes there's just some general language, and sometimes the provision simply exists. So purpose statements are quite important, but a lot of them aren't specifically represented in law. The report must contain, as John mentioned, revenue loss estimates for the preceding biennium and the current biennium. So this particular book will have the 13-15 estimates as well as 15-17 estimates. And just a couple of notes about the revenue estimates that may be useful to you is that the estimates that are represented in the book won't represent the potential yield from eliminating the provision. And that results from a couple of sources. There are interactions between expenditures so that if you, for example, if you reduce a subtraction that might increase taxable income and consequently tax revenue, but if there's an unused credit that could be deployed there that would offset that change, that may not yield the full amount of what the subtraction represents. Similarly, there are a number of these provisions that are taken over a period of years and also have carry forwards. So if there's not sufficient tax liability to apply, say, a credit to, for example, it can be used in a future period. So eliminating the provision doesn't result in an instantaneous yield of the revenue that's represented in the revenue estimate. There's also a concept of, on the property tax estimates, of loss and shift. When property is exempt from property taxation, there is a specific loss to the taxing districts, and that's represented in the book as the loss component. But in some areas, for example, there will be fixed bonds that districts have imposed that need to be repaid by the remaining property within the district. So that will simply be a shift from the recipient of the tax exemption to the remaining property owners in the district. So you'll see in the property tax tax expenditures that there will be both this loss and shift component. So the loss can be interpreted as the loss to the taxing districts. The loss and the shift can be interpreted as the benefit to the owners of the tax-exempt property. And finally, related to revenue estimates, these were based on current law or law at the time that the publication was completed. And as Paul mentioned, there were some extenders that were passed, and these are examples. They were passed in December. They would be represented in the book as being expired. So, for example, the there's a subtraction for teacher classroom expenses that in our book will show a zero. It'll show it expiring in 15-17. That was renewed after the book was published. So there's a certain, I guess, decay, if you will, that occurs that after this is published, the estimates will change according to changes in law as well as economic conditions that might drive those. The also required is to identify a budget program or function associated with each of these tax expenditures. What we have done in the book is used the six categories in the governor's budget: education, human services. They're very broad categories, and then in some cases, as John pointed out, not all tax expenditures fit neatly into particular categories. So we've added four function areas, for example, those provisions that are prohibited by federal law don't fit those six budget categories, so we've added a couple of other ones. Now, one of the things that we've tried to develop, and Representative Whitsitt, maybe to your question, as we observe folks using this publication, it is quite imposing, and there are large numbers of these, and we think wherever it's possible to break them down into a little more bite-sized chunks, we think that might be useful. So we've been working a little bit, and I'm not sure that these are completely cooked, but what we've done is attempted to categorize the tax expenditures into more specific subject areas. So these are a little bit more specific than the six recommended budget program areas. So this is it's not in the published book, but it is on our website. So if you're interested in these categories, you can see each of the tax expenditures that fit within these. So, Representative Whitsitt, your question about energy, there are 24 tax expenditures that relate to energy, and these would be income tax expenditures, property taxes. There'd be a variety of them, but that would be where you could see all those in one place if you want to know those provisions. There's also a glossary in the publication that's at the end that may be kind of useful, a keyword glossary if you're looking for a particular provision. You may be able to find it more easily that way than mm-hmm. through some of the other means.
Now, you presented a document that's been published in our OLIS thing. That is these tax expenditures by subject area are the last two items on that single page, aren't they?
Yes, it's a page on our website, right?
Right, and it's a link to the
yes.
To that. Thank
yes.
you, colleagues. I think this is a very convenient one page. Way of getting into these documents online.
Mr. Chair, would you like me to go there and show some things?
I don't think so. It's in OLIS, so the members have it.
Okay.
Yeah. It's for those who don't have their computers here today, it is a document on the site for today's meeting.
And I might add that we would like to develop these further. I think this is a some of these provisions are, and in fact, some fit more than one category. You may have a medical provision that also deals with military, for example, and so they will show up in both cases here. So the totals, there will be some tax expenditures that will fit in multiple categories. But we think this would be a useful thing to develop further so that users of this book can have a little bit easier way to access the various provisions.
And yes, Representative.
Can I just clarify that even though they might fit into more than one category, you only list them once, or do you list them in? See what I'm asking?
Mr. Chair, Representative yeah. Smith Warner, they're listed both twice.
Oh, they are listed
yes,
both.
Yes, they'll be
okay.
in both places.
Oh, okay.
So if you go to that site and look at mm-hmm. energy, and if there are some, if there's an energy provision that might be in another place, it will be in both places. Oh,
gotcha.
That's why the adding up thing doesn't work.
Yep, gotcha.
Yeah.
I was just impressed that you managed to categorize them all without resorting to a miscellaneous. It's very impressive.
Three other items that are required by the book is a description of who benefits from the provision. And I might point out that where we have more extensive information, we provide some pretty useful detail, like on the tax credits or the tax subtractions. If you go to the descriptive material in these provisions, we'll provide material about the number of claimants relative to the population by income category, so you can see whether it's claimed more heavily by lower or higher income, or if it's uniformly distributed. So we attempt to use all the information at our disposal to provide that beneficiary information. Another element that's required by the book is an evaluation along two lines. The statute requires that they be evaluated according to whether they achieve their purpose, and also whether they're the most fiscally effective means of achieving their purpose. And the process by which that's done is we coordinate kind of an information flow with about 28 other agencies that have subject matter expertise or program responsibility for these various tax expenditures. And these agencies are the entities that conduct the evaluations. So if you look at the evaluations in the tax expenditure report, the particular agency that conducted the evaluation is attributed. And then finally, sunset recommendations for those provisions that are going to sunset in 15-17. The book provides recommendations about whether the provision should be extended or the sunset should be allowed. And I believe Chris is going to talk about a predominant component of those with the 18 credits. So generally, I guess I'll just conclude with just describing Department of Revenue's role in producing the tax expenditure report. We identify and describe new or modified or deleted tax expenditures. And John just mentioned how difficult some of these are. There's actually some kind of intellectual challenge with identifying what tax expenditures are there and what are not. So we actually enjoy that a bit, but it's kind of a challenge that we're trying to be as comprehensive as possible. And one of the things is John's describing the concept of tax expenditures. The established tax concept, we really rely on the existence of a provision in statute to gauge whether or not, or to help us whether or not it is a tax expenditure. We also produce all of the estimates.
Excuse me just a moment. Representative Vance?
Thank you. So focusing on that for a moment, that you have to define what a tax is first in order to do that analysis. So what's your source? What's your definition of a tax?
Mr. Chair,
is that money flowing? Is it revenue coming in? Is that the most basic thing, a tax, for purposes of your analysis?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Benz, well, if I could use an example, the corporation tax, for example, would be comprised of the tax base and the rates, which would represent an established tax, and then deviations from that are explicitly stated in statute would represent tax expenditures.
What I'm getting at is, excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, please go ahead. Yes.
I'm. It's bothered me for a while. When we looked at the Obamacare effort and the Supreme Court's analysis of why that was constitutional, the issue came down to an interesting one of you could opt out by paying a fine, which was determined to be constitutional as a power to tax. The issue is, at what point does a mandate become a tax? That's the issue. And so I'm just asking, this is, when you say things are complicated, you are right. And I just want to make sure we don't just skip over that one little element of what we're talking about too quickly. But what I think in my other conversations, that's almost always resulted in the conclusion that if you have to write a check out to the state, that's probably a tax. And that may be where it stops, as opposed to a mandate where I tell you I have to do something, and thus you'll go do it. Cost you money, but you don't pay me. And exactly. But anyway, I'm going just to take it for granted that the analysis you guys did started with finding a exercise where somebody paid the state some money, and that's a tax. As opposed to a fee, which, as I just mentioned.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Bancy, I think that's true. I mean, we really use statute as a guidance, as it describes the established tax.
The taxes, exactly.
If the legislature calls it a tax, it probably is.
Yes.
Thank you.
Oh, Representative, what's...
Good question that I'm not really sure how to ask this, but have you determined how many of our either tax expenditures, however you want to label this, or tax credits, are going to corporations headquartered outside of the state of Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, we don't report that information. There may be some background information that we could work with LRO staff to help provide more descriptive information. That is not reported specifically in the report.
Yeah, even a percentage would help us to understand if we are giving, instead of receiving taxes from, you know, things that are going on in our state, if that money is going out of our state, it would be interesting to know how much we're crediting people outside of this state for using things in our state, if you will.
Sure, Barnhart, I agree. I think that's a great point. It would be lovely to see that broken out.
Right. And of course, the department prepares this report based on the statutory requirements and then a few things that we've sort of added on since that time. That kind of a question is a great question, and generally speaking, what we would do is direct that question to the Legislative Revenue Office, and then they might go and cajole the department into doing the analysis, or they might do it themselves, depending upon how much work there is. But it's not part of the report, is it? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think it's an excellent question for us to be asking.
Mr. Chair, I was about to defer to Legislative Revenue Office there. So but, you know, we'll work closely with Paul and provide whatever information we can.
Yeah, that's what the word cajole means.
And Mr. Chair, because we do already, and we had some in yesterday's discussion, we do get some analysis on the revenue, on the tax revenue side. It is divided that way, so, that's it.
Mr. Chair, we do have, for example, with the income tax, we have a non-resident number on that. Yeah. It's basically from Clark County, but we know what a lot of it is.
But we actually have a return that says non-resident.
We have a non-resident return, and we have corporations domiciled in Oregon versus outside of Oregon. So we've got those kind of measures. Some of the other less, the excise taxes might be more difficult.
Do we have a bill this time on modification of the requirements for the preparation of this report? I'm not sure.
I don't believe we haven't directed at this. We do have ones that may be directed the kinds of information
that's available to us. I mean, you know, we might think about the question that the representatives at the end of the table here have raised. Representative Whitsitt raises a very, very good question, and maybe that's something that ought to be analyzed. And if it's not included in this report, then at least made available to you for our purposes.
The other kind of not directly related, but somewhat related issue that we have asked the department, you have asked them, is the tax gap in terms of what's collected versus what's theoretically could be collected.
Right.
We've had that report. I think we had that report.
Part of that's compliance, isn't it?
That's a compliance at the
beginning. Right. I mean, some people just don't pay their taxes.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay.
Not just people.
Thank you for the question. I think that's a very, very good one.
Well, Mr. Chair, the last thing is really just that the department coordinates. There are a lot of folks that work on this report. As I mentioned, there are about 28 agencies that participate in the evaluation. So part of our role is to coordinate the flow of information between those agencies, the DAS, Chief Financial Office, and the Governor's Office to facilitate those evaluations. So that is really what we had today. Answer any other questions?
Other questions for our panel? I want to say that I have been working my way through this report. I think it still has some ways to go, as I'm sure you agree, but it is it's a great improvement in terms of the information provided in many, many places than the reports that we've seen in the past. And although, colleagues, this thing looks like a phone book, it really reads much faster than a phone book, and so I'd commend it to you to take a look at it. It's inspired me to raise a number of questions about tax credits, various tax expenditures, many of them, interestingly, in the property tax area, where I don't know much about some of them, and they seemed a little unusual to me, and maybe sources of revenue as we look at them. So I appreciate the more thorough this report is, the more likely it is to be useful to us, and I appreciate the fact that that it's getting better.
Thank you.
Anything else? Anything else, Paul, today?
We have one more report.
Oh, we have another report.
Yes.
Oh, I was ready to go home.
Not going to let you go early.
not early. Okay.
Maybe tomorrow. Chris has a related report, a kind of a good, I think, follow to this. This was a report that was specifically required in House Bill 2002. And so this is the inaugural report. We see this as an ongoing, with the statute now requires us to update you, give a report every 2 years on the expiring tax credits. And so, Chris, this is the first maiden voyage of this. And we see it as an interactive report, so we would appreciate input from you on things you think might be helpful to add or things that may not be useful to have in there. So we'll hope we'll get some good feedback from you on this.
Ah, and I just refreshed my page and discovered that, in fact, it is listed under meeting materials. It wasn't when the meeting started. Please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. And I guess the one thing that I would add to the setup that Paul just provided is that the report is not intended to be the end of the word on any of these tax credits. It's really just meant to further along the conversation and provide some initial material for the policy committees as they grapple with the policies in the tax credits. And that's really, a lot of it boils down to the biggest value added would be a very clear statement, as clear as possible, about what the tax credits are supposed to do. What is the purpose behind them? Because that really sets the framework for evaluating them as to whether or not they're able to achieve those. So I was just going to talk mainly about the structure of the report. And this is, it's set up this way. There are three sections of the report. First one is tax expenditures. It provides background. You just got that with the full tax expenditure report. The second piece talks about the tax credit review process that has been in place in 2011 and 2013. So veteran members will be familiar with that. New members, a little flavor for how that happened over the past couple of sessions. And then the meat of the report, if you will, is in Section 3, where each of the tax credits is discussed individually. And kind of following on some of the steps in the tax expenditure report, in an attempt to categorize and organize this somehow, they are grouped into five different themes, where we have healthcare tax credits, childcare tax credits, disability tax credits, business investment tax credits, and financial independence. And even as you glance down that list, you could see where they could fit into other categories, but it was really just a mechanism to get this moving forward.
The substantive committees have copies of this report.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So primarily for the newer members, just a more context on where this report came from. Since 2007, there have been a number of bills that kind of have brought us along this path. In 2007, there were a number of tax credits that were created or modified, and they were paid for all in the same bill by phasing out the personal exemption tax credit. So it was kind of the initial tax credit omnibus bill, or initial, at least within my history. In 2009 was really the initial where all of the tax credits were grouped into three categories, and a sunset date was placed on all of them so that every 6 years, all of the tax credits will have received some sort of review. And as Paul mentioned before, this is the third group. So after this session, all of them will have gone at least through some form of initial review. 2010, there was a bill that made significant policy changes to the business energy tax credit, to Representative Whitsett's point. The 2011-2013 bills were the tax credit omnibus bills, which has been the model that has been used the past two sessions. And then in 2013, there was another bill, 2002, Paul just described, that was the creation of this report. So going back in 1995, you had the tax expenditure report, and then fast forward to 2013, now you have a report focusing on 18 credits that are due to sunset in an attempt to help to focus some of the policy discussions. And this table right here provides some context for the revenue impacts that are involved. It has, for four biennia, 2013-15 through 19-21, that top row is the current law impact with the sunset. And that's why it falls from $144 million last biennium to $107 million this biennium, and then eventually going down. Those sunsets take place, and there are carry-forwards among the credits, so that extends the revenue impact, and some of the tax credits actually are taken over multiple years. And that middle line is the cost of the sunset extension. You can see the $64 million that was referred to earlier. And the revenue impact for all of those, you have the $64 million, the $135 million, and then $153. So the bottom line just sums those together so that if there were no sunset to any of these tax credits, you'd be looking at a revenue impact that approached $180 million in 17 and 19. Again, just context for the total picture. And this table, and I apologize for the small print, is some of that detail. It's each of the categories, the healthcare and childcare. So within healthcare, we have six tax credits that in one way or another are related to healthcare. The four columns on the left are the revenue impacts under current law, so you can see the phase outs occurring there. And then the four columns on the right will be the cost to extend those sunsets. And these are all the revenue impacts. Basically, they are the revenue impact that we would put on any bill at the moment. Now, we'll be getting more information from the Department of Revenue, so these may change during the course of the session, but this gives you a sense for the magnitude.
I have a question.
Representative Whitsett.
Back on the disability, is there any overlap between the state and federal on the disability, you know, the child or elderly that's permanently disabled? Anything within that amount, does it overlap with federal credits, if you will?
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsett, yeah, I think the short answer is yes, it's the elderly and permanently disabled that is a function of the federal credit.
Okay.
So we piggyback on that credit.
Do we pay a part of it then, or do they pay through the state? I mean, you know what I'm asking. I'm not saying it right, but
I think I know what you're asking, okay. So I'll attempt to
okay.
answer.
Okay.
If I'm eligible for that tax credit, I fill out my federal tax form, and I claim that credit against my federal taxes.
Right, okay.
And that credit will be $100 or whatever it is.
Right.
Then when I go to fill out my Oregon tax return, I'll fill that out, and there'll be a line on the Oregon tax return that is that credit. The calculation is different, but then I would fill that out, and then so for that same disability, I get a federal credit against my federal taxes and a state credit against my state income taxes.
Are they equal?
They accumulate. You get the federal one plus the state one.
Right, and I wondered if they were equal as, okay.
No, they're not.
Okay. Can I follow up?
Please, yeah.
Is there anything else on that list? I assume up in the healthcare probably also that is duplicative of federal.
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsett, there are two or three in here that are tied in one way or another to a federal law. trying to go off the top of my head, I'm not sure that any of the healthcare ones are tied to federal law. The ones that I think are, and the child care, you have the child independent care credit that piggybacks on federal law.
Overlap whether they're linked or not.
The elderly are permanently disabled.
So the other committees.
And under business investment, there's a qualified low income community investments that's basically an Oregon new markets tax credit. So that part of the, that, and there is a federal new markets tax credit. And that is a new tax, relatively new tax credit. We leverage the federal process. Basically. So those are the three that come to mind as being tied to federal law in one way or the other.
Yeah. Could I follow up?
Yes, please.
Is there any way for you to draw us or make a graph that we can see how much overlaps with the federal in terms of if they're not equal to each other, what would it look like if you took out Oregon's contribution, if you will?
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, I haven't done that everywhere, but that is the kind of thing we are capable of doing, and that would be the idea behind providing that information and answering those questions this session. I do have a table in here, a graph for the child care credit that includes the Oregon child care credit, the working family child care credit, and the federal child care credit, where I've attempted to provide at least one example of how that might look. So I can jump to that in a minute if you'd like.
Thanks.
I think Representative Whitsitt has hit on an interesting point, because I think this information might be very useful for the policy committees as they consider whether or not they want to recommend that we renew these credits or modify them in some way. And that I don't think we should ever look at incentives without knowing who else is providing an incentive and what it is in the same general area. Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense to me that we do that. And I don't think we do it in an organized way, but I think we do it.
And I can jump to that example in a minute if you'd like or not. So setting that up, so now we have basically the five core chapters of the report, and each starts, there's a one or two page introduction setting it up. So here, just going to talk briefly about the healthcare one. So on this page, there's a table here that tries to draw, the goal here is to try and draw more explicit links between indirect spending and direct spending. So here, for example, under a category I've labeled rural and underserved, we have the rural medical providers tax credit. So that's an example of the indirect spending and in the tax expenditure report. The four programs beneath that are direct spending programs that go through the Ways and Means process that help provide assistance to rural medical providers in one way or another. So you have the Medicaid Primary Care Provider Loan Repayment Program, the Scholars for a Healthy Oregon Initiative, the Oregon State Loan Forgiveness, the Rural Medical Practitioners Insurance Subsidy Program. I just say that because to show you that I can read. I don't know any of the details about those programs. We worked with LFO to get some budget numbers here. We have the 13-15 numbers here, and again, this is really gets at the point about just moving the ball down the field, so to speak. If people aren't offended by sports metaphors, trying to move the discussion down and just provide a context, because there is some question as well as disagreement about the link between indirect and direct spending.
Yeah, could I just simply add, what we've been doing with these kinds of issues is that we've asked the policy committees to actually review these tax credits and give us their hit, not on necessarily on the dollar number, but on the efficacy and value of the credits, and then make a recommendation to us. And we have a set of issues that we've asked them to look at, and I think Chris is actually going to be working with those committees as they do that. I may be getting ahead of what you plan to talk about. I don't know.
No, that's correct, Mr. Chair. My primary role this session is to be as available as possible to all of the policy committees. So to the extent you're in other policies committees that have these tax credits, you may get tired of seeing me. So.
Right. But the point is, we farmed all of these out. This has been something we've done for a number of sessions now. We farmed all these issues out, and we've asked the policy committees to tell us, is this worthwhile? Should we keep doing this? Should we change it so it functions in some other way? And then we get all these reports back, and the tax credit committee that we're half of, in effect, will figure out what to send to the floor to try to get passed. And in every session that we've dealt with these so far, in 11 and 13, we've abandoned some, we've modified some, and we've adopted some the way they were before. I think all your questions are really very appropriate questions, and I have to say, Chris, that I like this chart you've put together because mm-hmm. I think this is a better way of reviewing for the policy committees, reviewing the totality of the policies that we have in place as they look at the question we've asked them, which is only one small piece of it.
Correct. And all of that really gets at the purpose for doing these, and that's where hopefully there's value in comparing the indirect and direct programs together, because while, as noted in the presentation before, the policy intent may not be exactly the same, but in many respects they should be the same, or at least we think they are the same, and that's why they're included here. And having said that, this is not necessarily an exhaustive list either. It's a starting point. So that this is kind of the intro to the healthcare discussion, and then each tax credit. So this is the first page, the Rural Medical Providers Tax Credit, and the format is similar here. On the left there, we have the ORS reference and the Tax Expenditure Report reference. Where possible, I didn't try to copy everything from the Tax Expenditure Report, but it's another resource so you can link them together and find them easily. And then everything in that box, those are kind of core parameters around tax credits that often come up, and just trying to be very clear about which credits are refundable or not refundable, or if there's any kind of program cap or taxpayer cap. So within each one of these, there are four sections. We have a policy purpose, a description and revenue impact, a policy analysis, and then another issues. And so what I did for each of the policy purposes was went back to the implementing legislation from whatever year. So in this one, I went back to 1989, the records that I could find. And while there isn't necessarily a clear statement of the legislature thinks we need to do this to solve this problem, try to glean from the discussion some and infer some sort of policy purpose. So a refinement of this information would be really helpful and in the policy committees. And then we have a description and revenue impact that's just describing how it works and a high-level picture of the overall revenue impact. This one's a little unusual in that it has certification data. The Office of Rural Health certifies the tax credit. So we have a cap every year, a potential amount that could be claimed. And then that's the green line. And then the red dashed line is data from tax returns. That's the amount actually claimed. And then the blue line is the amount that is actually used to offset tax liability. So to bounce ahead, well, all of this, so here we start on the policy analysis. And this particular one, there's a fair amount of analysis here, talking about exploring some of the data that we have available, certification data, if it's around, tax return data, if we have, or even just raising questions about policy questions to consider. Again, not meant to be an exhaustive list of here are the three policy questions that should be answered, but something to get the discussion started. And then the last piece, there's an other issues, which normally deals with some sort of reference to the administrative costs of the tax credits. And the administrative costs would be on the state agencies, either issuing the certification or the Department of Revenue, or the taxpayer, any fees that they have to pay, or just regular record keeping. This part is pretty thin on data right now, but it's kind of a placeholder, at least for the concept, to acknowledge that that's another piece of tax policy, are the administrative costs. And another issue that often comes up is, what do other states do? Mm-hmm. You know, we have this credit, what are other states doing the same thing? So luckily we had the help of a couple of really great interns this past fall. and they had the joyous task of going to all of these other states and finding out what their tax expenditures they had in similar fashion. And in one of the appendices, there are the detailed tables if you want to thumb through each of those. But what I've provided in the report here is a key characteristic. So these are the levers that are used in all of the states. The attempt here is trying to be something that's more usable for the members to say, well, these are the common levers, whether it's a program cap, a rate, certain eligibility requirements, and so forth. And this is gleaned from the tax credits that exist in other states. And then at the end, there is this in summary box. And the goal was to fill out something everywhere, so an advantage, a disadvantage, and at least one potential modification. Some of them are stretched a little thinner than others, but the idea here was, okay, here's a reason for it, here's a reason against it, at least in the current structure or the policy. And then potential modifications, these are not LRO recommendations as to what should be done. It's really, here are some ideas.
Sure,
and again, it was provided because one of the questions we get a lot is, well, what do you think we should do? And so this is, again, just a starting point.
I like it.
So that's kind of the core structure of the report. And then it gets repetitive after that. Yeah. Now, there are a couple of exceptions. For example, the child care. There are four credits there. But the policy purpose of each of those seems to so clearly duplicate each of them that there's only one policy analysis for that chapter. Each of those credits is described, but then after the four of them, there's a policy analysis discussion. And to get at, see how quickly I can find this. So there, without going through all of the charts, here's an example of a chart. It's in the average credit that where we look at the working family credit, the Oregon CDC, child and dependent care credit, and the federal child and dependent care credit. So these are just average tax credits across income groups. And it's that kind of information that the chair was referring to in terms of stacking. That information can be put together in a number of ways. And rather than trying to attempt every possible way to put it together, again, just a flavor of the information that we do have available to us through the Department of Revenue. This is all from tax returns. So we're able to look at that and say, okay, so for the filers in the 30,000 to 40,000 income group, they got an average credit, working family care credit of, I don't know, $800, a few more $100 for the Oregon CDC, and then another $500 or so for the federal CDC. So in terms of crafting the Oregon policies, trying to provide a more comprehensive view of all of the incentives that are related.
I have a question just.
Representative Whitsitt.
So people are actually getting child care credits when they have incomes in exceedance of $100,000? Or am I looking
That's correct.
At that right?
Not the working family child care credit.
No, but.
The other two, yes.
What are the other two?
The child and dependent care credits. Okay. The way that federal credit is structured is that there is what we refer to as a phase down. So no matter what your income level is, you can get 20% of the credit. And then Oregon piggybacks on that. And interestingly enough, I was looking at that one because the Oregon one is so much larger than the federal one. And I wouldn't be surprised to if or when I dig into that I find something strange there. And so, not to get too much into the weeds yet, but a lot of it has to do with how these are tied. This greater than $100,000 is AGI. And these particular credits are tied to federal taxable income. Now, that's going to be tough to visualize, and I don't have any information to show how those map to each other, but it's possible for somebody to have federal taxable income that's $30,000 and AGI that's over $100,000 because Oregon has these additions, and there are Oregon additions to federal income, and there are a handful of taxpayers who pay these additions that they look like low-income people on the federal return, but you throw in these Oregon additions, and then they move up this income scale. There are a lot of taxpayers in it, and almost any weird circumstance you can think of, it comes through at some point. And it's analysis like this and information like this that brings that out.
Mm-hmm. It's
because it's not what you would think of. And but at the same time, I can't guarantee that there isn't a data problem.
These are unusual, one-of-a-kind kinds of tax returns, aren't they?
Generally speaking.
I mean, we're not talking about people who do this year after year after year, are we?
I don't think so. They could be. It has to do to really get into it. I would have to. It would involve a discussion of okay. Well, these are the Oregon additions, and the Oregon additions are income that the feds do not tax, but Oregon does. And if that is a large dollar amount, then you have a federal low-income person, so to speak, that is an Oregon high-income person.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative.
Could you just give one short example of something of it? And again, I know I'm really not trying to put you on the spot, but just one small example of an ad back that
I'm stretching my memory here. I haven't looked at it in a while, but I believe there's something related to bonds. There might be some sort of bond income. Again, I would have to double check that.
That we would count as income that the feds would not.
Yes.
Well, a tax-free bond from another state would be taxed in Oregon, but not by the federal government.
So that's
interest on, for example.
And that's why it comes to mind. So I think that's the best example, and it might even be the biggest. Generally speaking, there aren't a lot of these.
But of course, at that point, we're talking about people with significant assets, even if they don't have large income.
Another way of looking at that is there is a difference between wealth and income, and in some income streams like that indicate high wealth, but they might not have any other kind of income. They might not have wage income or anything else. So from that perspective, from that slice, they look low income. Wow. So that's pretty much just a very quick flavor of the information that's in the report, and this will be distributed to policy committees. And then I will be making myself available to the policy committees to answer whatever questions come up and try to work through and help them in any way I can to focus on a policy purpose and craft the best policy. I will say and some of the credits can be merged. I mean, you have a credit that – the two credits that do the same thing.
Good stuff.
Maybe there only needs to be one.
Yeah. So Representative Whitsitt's obvious skepticism here is one that suggests to me that this is one we're going to want to look at with a little more, because I think I may agree with her about that, at least the implication of the facial expressions I'm seeing.
It caught my eye.
Just to understand why we would give somebody who has more than $100,000 of income a child dependent credit.
Right.
Well, the federal is not limited by it's a phase down.
It's a phase down, mm-hmm. Right. Okay.
And there are limits to the eligible expenses on which the credit is based. The Working Family Child Care Credit, there is no limit to the eligible expenses.
Right.
So there are a lot of, within each of these, there are a lot of policies that the committees hopefully will hash out as to which ones make the most sense to move forward with.
Hmm. Thank you. Did you have other things you want to talk about? We're out of time. May I say, with the little look that I've had at this, and I'm going to read it all the way through, I really appreciate the work you've done to pull this together. There obviously is more to do, but 100-plus pages, it looks to me like you spent more than last summer on it.
It's been keeping me busy. And we did have two great interns.
Yes, that's wonderful.
And then Paul's tired of reading drafts.
And I suspect that the policy committees are going to find this very useful as they do their work as well.
Yeah. Hopefully that'll be the case.
Good. Thank you. Any other questions?
No, I think Rep. Davis said that the basics facts was one of the most exciting reports to come out this session. I think this is right up there.
Thank you. Representative Vega-Peterson, I completely agree with that statement.
We have another exciting report tomorrow, the Tax Haven report.
Excellent.
Now, that one really will be exciting. I do expect to see some ambassadors in their full regalia to discuss it with us.
No, we want the field trip.
Oh, you want the field trip instead. All right. Well, on that note, we finished our business for today, only 3 minutes late. See you all tomorrow. The House Committee on Revenue is adjourned.
Excellent.
Yeah.
That's really excellent.
Yeah,
that's really...